Democracy Now. This is the Heather McCoy Show.
KBOO Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. Most films will show at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, room 104 at PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Trillium Public Charter School in North Portland. Enrollment for the 2019 to 2020 school year is now open for students K through 12 with an open house on February 21st at 6:30 p.m. More information online at trilliumcharterschool.org.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is poet, musician, composer, and Torah teacher Alicia Jo Rabins. Rabins has a BA in English and Creative Writing from Barnard College, an MFA in Poetry from Warren Wilson, and an MA in Jewish Women's Studies from the Jewish Theological Seminary. A classically trained violinist, Rabins toured for 8 years as the violinist in Brooklyn-based klezmer punk band Gollum, and tours internationally as the songwriter and bandleader of Girls in Trouble, an indie folk song cycle about the complicated lives of biblical women. Rabins is also the composer of a one-woman chamber rock opera called A Kaddish for Bernie Madoff, about the intersection of spirituality and finance, which was named one of Portland's 5 best theater performances of the year by Willamette Week, and which is now becoming an independent feature film. In addition, as if that were not enough, Rabins is a bar and bat mitzvah tutor, Torah teacher, and conjurer of contemporary feminist Jewish rituals. Alicia Jo Rabins' debut book of poetry, Divinity School, was chosen by C.D. Wright for the American Poetry Review Honickman First Book Prize, and was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award. Her chapbook, The Girl Who Wants to Be a Landscape, was selected by Mary Oliver for the Artscape Poetry Prize. Her poetry has appeared in the American Poetry Review, Boston Review, Plowshares, among many other places, and she's here today to talk about her second collection of poetry out from Augury Books entitled Fruit Geode. Major Jackson says of Fruit Geode, "Against the tide of received wisdoms about mothering and loving, one can only marvel at the personal cosmology Alicia Jo Rabins builds in these poems. Fruit Geode amounts to a kind of ritualistic reclaiming of the body and spirit as mother and artist in the presence of both her progeny and her ancestors who watch as she spirits herself into song again and again." Lynn Melnick adds, "How does a body do what it does? Make love, mistakes, create life, exist after life. How does a body evolve, celebrate, regret, reconsider its big and small moments? These are the passionate concerns of Alicia Rabins' Fruit Geode, a book that I could not stop reading once I started, a book that drew me in with intimacy and force and then grabbed my heart hard, which is to say, if you have a body, this book is a must read." Welcome to Between the Covers, Alicia Jo Rabins.
Thanks, David.
So let's start with the title, Fruit Geode, which feels like an odd pairing of words, but also a pairing of words that really, I think, captures a lot of what the collection is wrestling with. So tell us what happened that created this pairing of fruit and geode.
I think the kind of large-scale meta-answer is that I'm generally obsessed with opposites and how they contain each other, and this, you know, the kind of maxim of as above, so below. And the literal embodiment of that, that led directly to this title, was having my two children and the process of pregnancy and birth, and the sense, I mean, specifically how a pregnant belly is this kind of taut, self-contained, geode-like orb that looks so simple from the outside, and then on the inside contains essentially this human fruit. And, you know, many people get these emails from websites that say the size of your fetus each day with, you know, compared to what fruit it's the size of. And just more broadly, how the natural world has, you know, the hardest rock and the softest fruit is all contained in nature.
Well, I kept sort of parsing what I thought the fruit was and what I thought the geode was in the collection, and they kept switching meaning. But one of the motifs of the collection is this idea of being broken open. And you've called being broken open an impossible combination of deliciousness and violence, and also a wild flourishing that is also a surrender to extinction. So in a way, when I was thinking of those, my first impulse was to associate the geode with the surrender to extinction and the fruit to the flourishing wildly. But you could look at it the opposite way, I think, also, that perhaps the beauty and the flourishing of pregnancy and early motherhood can only be found through going through it, which I think is something that you're evoking in Fruit Geode, that only by being broken open through the process do you see what's inside the geode. So in a sense, the geode would be the wild flourishing. And the fruit would be associated with extinction of something that appears and is transient and ephemeral, and maybe in the way that one's identity or one's body is consumed and irrevocably. But I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about this question of being broken in relationship to these images that you've put together.
Yeah. You know, I have to say I was blessed to have a healthy pregnancy and healthy outcomes, although difficult births of both my pregnancies. So I'm aware of the privilege of that. And it was even more shocking to me that within that privilege, I felt so completely, you know, so glad and overjoyed and aware of the blessings, and also so utterly kind of devastated and broken open by the loss of my previous life, especially with the first baby, which also coincided with moving across the country. So there was kind of a double, it was a very stark breaking for me from the 34 years I lived as one person. The transition to motherhood was, it was very complicated, and I experienced it as a kind of breaking. But I also, I think, you know, in the same way that you have to kind of split a melon open to get to the sweet part, and you have to, you know, a geode is this whole self-contained object, and not until you basically violently smash it open do you see the luminous, unlikely beauty inside of it. And so I think on both physical and emotional and spiritual levels, that really resonated with my experience. I mean, I think there's a natural human resistance to being broken. We don't want it. But so often on the other side of that brokenness lies sort of clear-eyed vision or a deeper awareness of what's actually happening. Because in the stories that we tell ourselves that keep us feeling whole in a tight way, there can be a lot of illusion, and there can be a lot of actually energy released in the breaking of that, even though it can be very painful.
I don't think you nod to this directly in Fruit Geode, but I wondered about the origin story or the birth story of the earth from a Jewish mystical perspective. So God fills 10 spheres, Sephirot, with his light or her light in different qualities of God fill these different spheres or Sephirot. But they can't contain it, so they shatter. And the earth that we know, according to Jewish mysticism, and maybe you can correct me if I'm characterizing this wrong, but the earth that we know is the hidden shards, the hidden luminousness of those original spheres. So in a way, it feels like this question of brokenness being a sort of wholeness in and of itself. So the world that we operate in is inherently a broken world. I wondered if that connected back, if this question of the geode connects back to this question of Jewish mystical origin stories.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not an academic expert in mysticism, so I may be wrong, but the way that I learned it is that there's a kind of Laurianic, so Rabbi Isaac Luria had a, who's a famous mystic, had an origin story where the world's, where God channeled God's energy into vessels. I'm not aware that they were the spheroid, but they might have been. And those vessels shattered because they couldn't handle God's light. And then these fallen vessels are the world, which means that each of them contains a spark of godly divinity. So when we eat food, for example, and then use that energy to do something positive in the world, that is releasing or liberating that spark, which again is a kind of breaking. I mean, you have to consume and destroy the food in order to liberate the energy inside it. And then the spherot that I'm aware of, so there's these sort of energy centers. There's a kind of beautiful tree of life map. And that the way that I learned it was that there's actually 10 levels of them, and so that where they kind of replicate, and the highest level is pure divinity, and the lowest level, not necessarily in a bad way, but just the lowest, is us on earth. And so they all, it's another kind of as above, so below, and so they all kind of reflect each other, and the light is filtered from the divine form into our forms, and our bodies also reflect. So our bodies also have essentially Jewish chakras, which are these energy centers that mirror the makeup of the divine energy, the energy channels of the divine, essentially. And it is in my book, actually, when there's a poem that ends that something about I lay on the birthing table and my body was split into two halves, compassion and judgment. And those are actually two of the spherot. And they're kind of two of the elemental ones that are opposite and necessary. Each is necessary, and the balance of them is necessary to kind of generate life.
Even though Fruit Geode was written in a different context than your first book, Divinity School. So for one, I believe that Divinity School is a collection of poems over a much longer period of time. Is that true?
That is true.
That is true. But also that Future Geode is more specifically focused on a period of life.
Absolutely.
So pregnancy and early birth and early motherhood. It still felt like there were some resonances thematically for me between the two books. Your first book has the epigraph by Carlo Levi that says, "The future has an ancient heart." And then this amazing introduction by C.D. Wright, which also feels like could be a skeleton key for a Fruit Geode. And I just wanted to read one of the parts of what she says about Divinity School. "This is a book that makes the great mysteries as real as potholes, but does not presume to know how to fill them. Nevertheless, the need to ask is enormous. She has a means of distillation that projects an impression of light around its object before dissolving back into the surround we must all fumble, grope, stagger through." So like this idea of the making of mysteries as real as potholes feels very alive in Fruit Geode to me, as well as this idea of the future having an ancient heart. And it makes me think of the ways over and over again you create an energy in your poems by insisting upon the contemporary as well as the ancient. So there's this juxtaposition or maybe a friction between the mundane and the sacred. And in this way, I think of the fruit as the present moment and the geode as the ancestry. But I don't know if this is a question, but I wanted to hear your thoughts about the ways that you try to take the mundane, the potholes, and somehow limb them to the mystery of being alive.
Yeah. Well, can I rewind for 1 second and just say that I felt like I didn't fully address your last question, the part about you know, the influence of Jewish mysticism and brokenness. And I pretty much everything I create is influenced by Jewish texts and traditions, which came into my life in my early 20s. So I didn't grow up with them very strongly, but I went very deeply into them when I found them. But also, I really love Buddhist teachings and practice, and you know, I've done a lot of yoga exploration. So I think, you know, I think in a way the structures of the Jewish texts are what I'm most familiar with in their details, but I do find this resonance with all of the spiritual practices that I've been involved with, that resonates with that sense of needing to break in order to fully awaken. I mean, even the Christ myth, I think. I mean,
well, there's also the Hasidic, I don't remember who said this, but it's something like, there's nothing more whole than a broken heart.
Yes, the Zohar, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And kind of having the courage to walk into the pain and pass through it that way, as opposed to spending your entire life trying to fend it off and never going through it. And then in terms of the question you actually just asked, and by the way, I say Christ myth respectfully. I the same way I would refer to my own traditions, legends, and stories as myths. I think part of what I spoke about at the very beginning of my fascination with as above, so below, and things containing their opposites is the fact that we live both in a moment that is constantly passing and is so infinitesimal and intangible, and yet we do have access to these millennia of human received wisdom and traditions. And, you know, we kind of touch it in the ancestors that we've gotten to know, parents, grandparents, and the, if we have children or if we teach children or just interact with the younger generation, we're touching through them the people who will come after as well. And that is a really central concern, I think, of everything that I do, including getting through the day, walking down the street, is just kind of balancing and negotiating how it is that we simultaneously live in these two modes, kind of like a point and a line at the same time. And one thing I really fell in love with when I got to know Jewish traditions and began to study them seriously is the way that ritual, to me, helps locate me in those vast millennial spaces while also bringing me fully into the moment. So ritual and ritual practice, and also studying texts that have been in so many other people's mouths for so many generations and hopefully will be, is another practice that sort of ties a knot where what your body and mind are doing at this moment is literally also part of a stream that has not stopped for many, many centuries. I think that's part of my way of just negotiating that essential mystery.
Would you read for us a beautiful virus, because I think that's one of the particularly good poems that show this juxtaposition of modes.
Beautiful virus, like arsenic in chocolate, like a pea shoot in mud, you broke me open into death in life. A beautiful virus, uncontrollably growing as the morning glories climb the raspberries that choke the grapes, that overrun the spinach. What I mean to say is, knocked off the pedestal of wholeness, now I watch you breathe in your miniature flamingo pajamas.
I've been listening to Alicia Jo Rabin's read from Fruit Geode. So the way you employ the pink flamingo pajamas to me, of sort of the modern ordinariness of that and the contemporary sort of relatability of it, seems to me like it serves as an antidote to the way the poem could wax poetically in sort of an elevated lyric about the glories of motherhood. There's some way in which I feel like switching registers there, for me at least, is one of the great pleasures of the poem. that when we get to the knocked off the pedestal of wholeness, it feels like you aren't just talking about giving birth and becoming a mother, but also that the pajamas are knocking the poem off of its pedestal of wholeness.
I love it.
But I didn't know if, I guess I, what I wondered is more on sort of like looking at an Ars Poetica, like, is there something about the poem not being too whole that makes it a better poem? I'm not saying this poem isn't whole, but I feel like there's some way in which the tonal switch knocks it off a sense of wholeness and somehow makes it a more whole poem at the same time.
Well, thank you. I mean, this whole book, the form, if you kind of flip through, is pretty different from Divinity School. My first book has a lot of dense, either short, dense kind of wisdom text style blocks, rectangular, almost prose poem blocks, or long, multi-stanza, dense poems. And most of the poems in Fruit Geode are either 1.5 or 2 spacing. And I was very, a lot of back and forth with my editor and publisher. I was very intentional about wanting this space and where it was 1.5 and where it was 2 and where it was actually combined. And I think part of that is the sense of, like, I didn't want to take this experience, which for me had a lot to do with absolute messiness, I mean, physical and emotional, and put a bow on it and make it palatable. I wanted to create poems that were kind of bloody and reflected, bloody and ethereal at the same time, like the experience was and is, and that which reflected that sort of, like, basically utter humility of being like, I don't have any answers. I'm kind of giving you impressions of what's happening right now. And I mean, I almost feel like I was, it's almost like every poem is a prayer to the reader to help me kind of understand this moment and do the best I can in it.
So is this idea of maybe knocking the poem off its pedestal linked very specifically to the fact that you're engaging with motherhood and the messiness of birth and motherhood? Or do you find that surprise shift and change of registers is an important part of poetry for you, or the quality that you value in poems?
I like to write in a lot of different modes. I really treasure, I mean, I make art in a lot of different modes, and then within each mode, I like to be kind of wide-ranging because it feels to me like freedom and possibility. So one of my most influential teachers was Kenneth Koch, who taught at Columbia when I was an undergrad at Barnard, so I would trek across the street to take all of his classes. And, you know, I took myself very seriously as a poet in high school, and he basically dumped cold water on the entire idea of taking oneself seriously as a poet. And simultaneously, he was a lifelong poet, you know, who had given his life to writing and teaching, which was just a beautiful combination. So he definitely was sort of like, whoa, let's keep it a little lighter here. Like, do we have to be kind of intense all the time? And from him, I think I learned that turn, which I kind of associate with Donne and Herbert and that era of being, you know, both highly intellectual, but also kind of trying to be light on your feet and, you know, kind of sexy and humorous. And I mean, I think it's part of also a way I like to try to live, where you're really deeply in the moment and really feeling it and really, you know, sitting with it, but also remembering the silly things and just kind of not taking your own narrative of the experience too seriously. And so I think poetically, I do love to play with that. That said, I also love poems that would never think to do that because they're so fully themselves in a different direction. So it's not like in my or anyone else's work I kind of need to check that box, but I do love it as a kind of craft move.
So you've quoted Allen Ginsberg in an essay that you wrote for Plowshares called Writing as Performance Art, where he says, don't get hypnotized into some false universe of pure imagery. And I think of this seduction of pure imagery as something your pink pajama strategy, and also making the mysteries as real as potholes, is working against. So maybe in line with the spirit of Ginsberg's quote. And I also think of like Afghan carpets where they always put, or traditionally you always would put a variation in the pattern because the idea was that if it was too symmetrical, it would be less pleasing to the eye, which made me wonder about your thoughts about the poem on the page, the poem confronted as a visual object, the one that's more static, so the more, let's call it the geode poem, versus the performance of the poem in real time, which you do in front of people. And especially because you are a performer independent of poetry, and also you've performed your poetry as to music. So I guess my long-winded question is, what role does the embodied performance aspect of the poem, the fruit version, what role does it play in creating the poem? So what process are you going through, if any, that's performative and embodied in terms of creating the poem on the page and informing the way the poem appears on the page? Does that make any sense?
It does. I'm trying to think of what my answer would be. Because when I'm writing, I write purely without editor brain. I mean, I just dip into some kind of stream of consciousness, you could say, and I just write whatever. And sometimes that ends up very close to the final form of the poem, and usually 90% of it gets thrown out. But it's like my critical brain is not welcome at that moment. And then when I start to edit on the page, I'm really thinking what works on the page. And I feel like the performance is a third step where it almost integrates them, where if I'm going to get in front of people and spend, I mean, I just have this resistance to impose anything on anyone to a fault. So it makes me it's been a challenge as a performer because I hate the idea of being like, hey, stop and listen to what I'm doing. But I do love holding the space. And I think because I grew up as a musician, I'm used to doing that. And so when I'm crafting a performance, whether it's of something that's a poem on a page or of something music that I've written, I'm very conscious of trying to kind of honor every second of the audience's attention, which is very different from stream of consciousness. And yet I'm completely in the present because there's almost no more meditative present act than performance, where there's no escape, and whatever's happening in your head is happening in your head, and whatever is it, you know, whatever arises, which is always unpredictable in live performance, you just kind of go with it. So in a way, I feel like there might be some sort of cycle from like the private act of generation and then the kind of in-between act of editing and then the so public, it's almost private again act of performance.
Well, I was hoping maybe we could hear that same poem you read, but this time with violin.
Yeah, sure. So I'll do that. Beautiful virus, like arsenic in chocolate, like a pea shoot in mud, you broke me open into death in life. A beautiful virus, uncontrollably growing as the morning glories climb the raspberries that choke the grapes that overrun the spinach. What I mean to say is, knocked off the pedestal of wholeness, how I watch you breathe in your miniature flamingo pajamas. Thank you.
So great having you on the show, Alicia.
Thank you so much, David.
We've been talking today to Alicia Jo Rabins about her latest book from Augury Books, Fruit Geode. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities or Mother Nature's recipes that bring the bare necessities of life. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, I couldn't be found.
Show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I am delighted to be joined by the artist and writer team who've collaborated on what may be the perfect book for Valentine's Day, at least for those readers who don't mind a little bit of surrealism with their romance. Adventures in Poor Tastes calls this book a fresh romantic comedy that shirks all the tired tropes of the genre, and Booklist describes it as